Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Wednesday afternoon session, the first Wednesday afternoon session, the Portland City Council, November 29th, 2017. Carla, please call the roll.
Udaly?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish? Saltzman? Wheeler?
Here. I read the full statement this morning. I'll just summarize it. Treat everyone with respect. There'll be opinions that are stated here that will not necessarily comport with your own opinion. That doesn't make it wrong, and everybody has a right to testify and to be heard and to be respected. So let's create a good, safe, and respectful environment for everyone. If for any reason somebody can't handle that, they'll be asked to leave. If they're asked to leave and they don't, they're subject to arrest for trespassing. Obviously, we don't want that to happen. If anybody is here as a lobbyist, council rules require you to please disclose that. If you're here representing an organization, that is certainly helpful as well. Traditionally, we do not take testimony on reports. I have made an exception this afternoon, so we will be taking public testimony. Usually we give 3 minutes, and I don't know, how many people do we have signed up, Carla?
We don't have a sign-up sheet.
Okay, well, if people would like to testify, find Carla. She's easy to find. She's right there. And we'll make a decision on how much testimony time. Plan for two, and maybe it'll be three, depending upon how much time people or how many people have signed up. We ask you not to express yourselves verbally. Thumbs up if you like something. Thumbs down if you don't. It tends to work really well. So with that, please read the first item.
Item 1271, accept the 2017 Portland Historic Landmarks Commission State of the City Preservation Report.
Commissioner Udaly.
Thank you, Mayor. It's a pleasure to bring forward this afternoon the 2017 Historic Landmarks Commission's State of the City Preservation Report. This commission will be presenting their 9th annual report before council, but this commission has actually been operating in the city of Portland since about 1975, providing leadership and expertise on preservation and on maintaining and enhancing Portland's historical and architectural heritage. This report comes to council at an important time for the city and its historic overlay districts. With the residential construction and commercial building industry in full swing, development pressure is increasing, and Portland's older neighborhoods and commercial corridors are under pressure. Our historic neighborhoods deserve the appropriate protection, and the development community deserve predictability that will enable us to meet our density and housing production goals. The Historic Landmarks Commission, sorry everyone, I've got a cold. continues to advocate for protection of the city's older building stock and for fair and predictable reviews. I look forward to hearing more today from the commission members and interested public, and am committed to supporting the commission in all of its efforts. Commission Chair Kirk Renzetta and Vice Chair Kristen Miner are here to present the report. Yes, they are. Welcome, commissioners.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, and my name is Kirk Ranzetta, and I'm joined by
Kristen Miner, and there are also most of the other Landmarks commissioners in the audience today.
Great, excellent, thank you.
If you would stand up just to, thank you. Karen Carl, I'd like to call out specifically Karen Carlson. This is actually her final week or so of being on the commission after 8 years of service. So I think it's fairly significant because she has been really integral in the preparation of these reports and made them a heck of a lot more readable and better to look at, certainly since I've been on the commission. I really want to thank City Council for the...
Can I suspend the rules and offer our congratulations?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity to come and talk to the council today about the State of the City report. In the introductory letter, I really wanted to highlight the folks of the City of Portland and their endeavors to conserve the built environment. Outside of what we do at the Historic Landmarks Commission, outside of what City Council does, and outside of what other organizations do that are dedicated to preservation. It's really the bottom line is that the folks of Portland individually often undertake efforts to conserve our heritage without the expectation of recompense sometimes. And I think that it was important to me to, you know, as my final year as chair, to make sure that message got sent across to our political decision makers too, because I think we're at a critical time now where I think the you know, we need to kind of lift up the folks of Portland to kind of take historic preservation to the next level. And I think that's the primary message of our report this year. I wanted to highlight also that we are a commission of 7 members, and we have several new members who've come on the board fairly recently, and we continue to change and evolve over time with a great number of folks with very specialized and very high level expertise in the field. I also wanted to have a shout out to our staff on the commission, both Hillary Adam and Brandon Spencer Hartle, who have provided us with very great guidance over the past several years, in their service to the commission. This is just a very quick and dirty map of Portland's designated historic resources, just to kind of give you the impression of where they are located. These are the designated resources, so they include historic districts and as well as individual properties. And what you'll see from that distribution is that they are largely centered on the west side, as well as in some of the pockets of districts that we have, such as Irvington and Ladd's Addition, and then also the other big one is Mount Tabor. But what you'll also notice is that there is some fairly significant blank spots in the city where there are very few designated resources, more specifically to the east side of 82nd, and then also south, largely of Division. When you look at the distribution of resources, they definitely peter out the further you go away from Center City.
Before you move from that, for staff, there's another two miles of Portland below where it's being cut off. So if we could possibly have the talking to staff, it's obviously not your provision. I'd really like to be able to look at what's in the whole city rather than getting chopped off at Vermont.
Right. Definitely agree to that.
And if I might just add that doesn't mean that there aren't historic resources in those areas. It just means they haven't been designated.
Right. And we'll be talking about kind of the need for the update of the HRI. That's one of the reasons why we'd really like to have that updated, is to get a better understanding of what's out there, because it's largely not understood at this point. Over the past year, we've had a number of different accomplishments with City Council's signature. We now have the new Chinatown, Japantown Historic District guidelines. We've also provided several correspondence and advocacy pieces to City Council, as well as to BDS and BPS staff on the 2035 Comprehensive Plan, the DOZA, the Residential Infill Project, as well as several pieces of legislation and rulemaking, including House Bill 2007, Goal 5 rule changes, and some other ongoing legislative work. We've had quite a few public hearings this year. We've had 26 public hearings that you'll see the breakdown in the slide. And we've also had a commission retreat with city staff, and we were also joined by Commissioner Udaly's chief of staff to kind of sit in and understand some of the range of issues that we've been experiencing over the past year. Staff should be commended for the number of different cases that they've been experiencing over the past year. Certainly an uptick over the past several years in terms of the number of applications for Type 1, Type 1X, and Type 2 applications. We've also been reaching across the aisle to some of the other commissions, including the Design Commission, as well as the Planning and Sustainability Commission. We get together just to kind of understand some of the broader issues that each of the commissions are facing within the development world. And we've also been fortunate enough to be presented or to be working on the Historic Resource Inventory Plan, which was fortunately funded this past year.
And now we're going to highlight a few issues, five of them to be specific, and we'll start here with public perception. Now, this is an interesting one because over the past year, or maybe a little more, it seems that there have been a lot of kind of unfair accusations, lobbied especially at historic districts, but even preservation as a whole, that it represented people who kind of wanted to just pull up the ladder, that maybe it was keeping out the wrong kind of people, perhaps NIMBYs, you know, or blocking density. Kind of clipped out a few headlines just as examples there on the bottom. And the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission is on record supporting added density in all of our historic districts. If that density is secondary to the historic pattern and the buildings. So it's really the zoning that prevents density, not any historic designation. And because of this, we do recommend that the 2035 comp plan should include some additional incentivizing tools to promote adaptive reuse. We also wish to remind Council how important it is for an updated historic resources inventory so that we do, you know, we can even know what's historically significant, especially in areas that have never been surveyed. The last HRI, or historic resources inventory, was in the early 80s. That was a long time ago. And then finally, cultural outreach and incentives so that we can get historic designation for more modestly scaled areas. It's important for us all to hear these stories. It's not just stories of the sort of more wealthy individuals in Portland that are important. Next issue is housing affordability. And this is a very complex issue, but it does bleed into historic preservation, primarily with the issue of demolitions. And there have been a continuing spate of demolitions, especially smaller, older housing across our entire east side of the city. Also, you know, just to point out that it is often the older buildings that are precisely those that are the more affordable buildings in the first place for rent. And we can learn from other municipalities. So I'm citing here one from Chicago who developed a system of incentives and kind of preservation policies to ensure that all of their single-family housing could be rehabilitated and more density could be added, but that specifically all of their what makes Chicago so so important in terms of their close-in suburbs is all of these 100,000 bungalows, as they called them. So our recommendations here are that, yes, we can definitely learn from other municipalities, that we can take these lessons, as well as our own observations, that allowing unchecked demolition does not result in new affordable development.
Can I just make a comment on this? Because I saw in your report there's a at page 8, there's a little profile of the Brana Apartments, the 11,
yes,
which is one of the 11x13. And it's an excellent write-up, but what is missing from the write-up is how controversial that was when it was actually on our radar. And because it's an older building, there was some additional costs associated with preserving it.
Right.
And so we got into this, you know, quagmire of, well, I mean, you can drive down costs by doing housing somewhere else. as if there was an infinite supply of replacement land, an infinite supply of replacement dollars to build housing, and that there was actually an apples to apples. And in spite of some vociferous critics, that building was preserved. And what I find particularly, what I'm particularly proud of about that building is it houses the lowest income, typically most disabled older adults in our community, across from probably one of our premier parks, juxtaposed in the heart of our city. And to me, that speaks volumes about our priorities as a city, that we would preserve that building and help fund this beautiful park adjacent to it. But cost became a big factor, and some housing advocates were highly critical of the cost of preserving that. And my view was, compared to what?
Yeah.
I mean, there isn't some replacement housing two blocks away, and it would cost more to do new. And it is a treasure. That building is an irreplaceable treasure, in my opinion. So, but I appreciate the write-up, and I appreciate the context you're giving us about housing affordability.
Okay. Very good.
You know, I would definitely agree with you on that particular project and looking at some of the record behind it. And also, it's an example of how public and private sector can engage in projects that increase the opportunity for affordable housing within the inner city of Portland. And why not put some of the most vulnerable folks in historic buildings that engender a tremendous amount of civic pride? So I think that, you know, I think it's a great point.
And before I move to the next slide, I just wanted to make one more point that the Portland Historic Landmarks Commission definitely has talked about and volunteered to be kind of part of a working group to really work on further incentives that prioritize the retention of housing. And these are complex issues. There's no question that sometimes it can be cost. Sometimes it can be, lead paint. There are issues, but we would like to volunteer to be part of a working group to continue to work on incentives. Next issue is really about development and compatibility. Compatibility is a critical component of historic resource reviews, which is what we do. And specifically in historic districts, everything within a certain boundary is meant to retain a visual coherency. So it's meant to be understood as a whole. And that's why compatibility is so critical for most of the new projects that we review in a historic district. We have pointed out that height, massing, and volume are a big part of compatibility. And providing maximum heights or FARs that are way above those in a historic district tends to put us in a contentious situation, because sometimes we have to say no at a fairly late stage in design where a developer might already be counting on achieving those maximums.
How could that be addressed? How do you see that being better addressed?
Well, the first recommendation is that we are asking you to consider lowering some of the heights, especially in central city historic districts, to be a little closer to those of the historic buildings. And also just it's not only lowering them, but making them more uniform within the district. Some of those districts, such as the Japantown, Chinatown, are currently have kind of wildly differential heights, which really have nothing to do with the historic district and the reason why it is a historic district. So we're looking for uniformity as well as somewhat lowered heights. You know, we don't mind working through contentious issues, but it's best just to limit that.
Well, it's important to set the playing field and set expectations. So I hope you'll be coming back in the hearings on that and making your point again.
Yes, we will. We will.
Can I just make an observation about uniformity? Because there's a whole school of thought that we've been hearing from. Mark Edlin is probably a good example, but there are others. And I'm going back many years. The last time we took up the cast iron district and some zoning changes. And some very thoughtful people in our community have made the case that having different heights and shapes and uses, even in a historic district, helps enliven places that are otherwise at risk of their continued fate currently, which is too many vacant spaces that are
Absolutely.
Dedicated for parking and others. And I've struggled with this myself because I completely understand what you're saying in terms of context. And, you know, when you look at some of your earlier slides, there's some buildings that really are just an insult to the character of the neighborhood they've been built in. But I'm also thinking that, you know, where the market has not been very helpful in generating activity within some of these districts, do you create a little flexibility in height and in style to enliven and activate a district? And at what point does that tip into actually potentially robbing us of the historic designation? I mean, that's it. And you know, Mark Evelyn's no slouch, so when he comes in and makes his case, we pay attention. But I'm torn between these competing views.
Yeah, I mean, I think that particularly in the Chinatown Historic District, you're dealing with a district that where the contributing non-contributing status is roughly 50-50. And as soon as it starts dipping below that 50% mark is when the integrity of the district really gets called into question. But I would agree with you that in terms of our consideration of height, we also kind of take into account context as well. So if there are taller buildings within a specific area close to where a proposed development is, that is something that we do take into account. So but I think the idea behind uniformity helps to kind of establish expectations in terms of what the developer is expecting when they come in through the door for a proposed development. But we have been, I think, open to additional height when it's sensitive to context. It's when you see the real disproportionate relationship between buildings is when the issue, I think, of compatibility becomes foremost in our own minds, and there's not anything around it to kind of help it be more of a part of the neighborhood, so to speak.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I think
okay.
We can move on. Yeah.
Okay.
So resiliency and sustainability. Let's see. As we acknowledge and prepare for the potential of a big seismic event, I think it's worth just a reminder that historic buildings and resources are really valuable. And they're not only valuable now, and some of the reasons for that are those places set the mood and the character in areas of our city. They encourage tourism and affordable housing in some cases. But they're also valuable later. And I have never been through a big disaster myself, but I have done some reading, and there are many studies that after a disaster event, those places are what help reorient people and remind people kind of who they are and where they are and to want to rebuild. So we are really asking not only, again, for more funding so that the HRI can really begin to be implemented in areas around our city, but also for better solutions and incentives for owners of URMs. That's unreinforced masonry buildings. Those are a difficult question because it does take quite a bit of money to structurally support such buildings, but many of those are historically important, and we should put resources where we can. And then finally, just that disaster planning in general across the city, which we've done a lot of at the city and local level, should include designated historic resources.
Could you be a little more specific on that? What do you mean by that? Just help me understand a few more talking points.
Yeah.
Sure.
Historic resources get a special consideration from FEMA, especially when in a post-disaster event, FEMA will come in and try to decide, or hopefully the work is already done for them, which resources should really get their first attention. And if we have resources kind of hierarchically ordered, in other words, if we've done some of this work to say, yes, look at our HRI, we've surveyed a lot of these areas of the city, and here's where we should really focus on preserving buildings, then FEMA will come in and say, great, I see that you've done this work. We can speed up funds to rebuild these specific buildings or areas.
And I was just going to add, typically whenever there is a disaster and FEMA does come in, they do have contracts with a variety of different firms to actually come in and evaluate and assess the impact of a disaster on a historical resource, such as when the hurricanes moved through the Caribbean. A number of different architectural historians actually went to St. Croix, currently in Puerto Rico, Houston, and Florida, because the historic resources are a vital component of their economy. They rely upon heritage tourism as a component of their economy, and I think that FEMA's attention to historic preservation is not only related to kind of a Section 106 of the National Historic Preservation Act, which obligates them to consider the impacts of their funding on historic resources, but they are also obliged to get people up and running again. And a part of that economics is making sure that these resources survive so that people have a place to visit when they visit.
Thank you. I appreciate that clarification. Thanks. That's helpful.
So the last component or issue we wanted to talk about today is the recent regulatory efforts through House Bill 2007 and the Goal 5 rule revisions. One of the things, and I think it just comes from a lack of experience in terms of trying to work with both city council and legislators on proposed legislation. And one of the things we were, I think, somewhat frustrated by was wanting to be an advocate for the historical resources of the city, and to provide city council with solid advice and recommendations concerning the legislation, but we didn't have that connection with the legislature. And I think there was a recommendation from staff to definitely go through the Office of Government Relations so that we don't, breach protocol in terms of providing our opinions in regards to a specific piece of legislation. And on the one hand, I think we understand City Council's desire to, be able to provide kind of a united voice behind a legislation coming out of Salem. But on the other hand, we also felt fairly strongly that there was some significant potential detrimental impacts from that bill on historical resources in the city. And so one of the things we wanted to explore with City Council was an opportunity to perhaps provide a bit more of an independent voice when it came to such legislation. That was certainly one of the things that we had talked about as a commission and wanted to kind of take your pulse on, because I know that there are other commissions, obviously, in the city that have a wide variety of opinions in regards to legislation coming out of Salem. And we wanted to see how could we best convey our message to the legislature.
Commissioner Fritz?
So we all sign an agreement at the beginning of the legislative session saying that we're not going to go down and advocate independently. And what I have found is getting the values and principles into the city's legislative agenda and then Office of Government Relations is your people down there. So we're coming up on the setting of the agenda for the short session. I do think it's unfortunate when particularly the Portland delegation gets conflicting advice and doesn't know who's speaking for whom, and what it can be very confusing and very detrimental to the whole package. So I've certainly learned over 9 years that while I may have some very strong opinions, and I occasionally do, as a private citizen, contact my own legislators to tell them this is what I think, it has to be very carefully done so that you're not speaking for a commission or the council without coordination.
Okay. Well, we would certainly love to, I think, have a dialogue with City Council as to how best to work with the Office of Government Relations so that we can better, I guess, understand the pulse of kind of what the city's priorities are when it comes to legislation affecting historic preservation. Because sometimes, you know, we spend a lot of time on these letters, we send them, and then we don't always get necessarily a response or a dialogue. We know you guys are busy, but I think it would really benefit us to kind of understand where folks sit, although on that particular piece of legislation, I don't think necessarily City Council took a position. And that we understand that that's an option, that you know, on occasion, you may not want to kind of enter into that fray.
Well, the other thing I would encourage you to do is to call our chiefs of staff with your concerns so that they can run it up the flagpole and make sure that, you know, we know what you want to happen.
Right.
And occasionally, even quite often, the Office of Government Relations will organize community members to go down and do their lobbying, and I found them extremely helpful.
Okay.
No, just to amplifying that, you really have three bites at the apple. You have the absolute right to lobby the council to put an item in our legislative agenda and prioritize it.
Yep.
You have the absolute right to work with statewide advocacy groups that already have lobbying presence, and there's no shortage of folks that are already down there with relationships. And as Commissioner Fritz said, you have the absolute right as a citizen to speak. The reality is we want to avoid as much as possible conflicting messages, because what happens is leadership that contacts us and says, we're not sure who's on first. And so you may think that there's a benefit. We then get the blowback saying, now we're confused. And we have to then sort out the protocol stuff. And that doesn't help your cause or our cause. Right. But don't give up on trying to get alignment with us.
Okay.
Let's see if we can get alignment or some pathway.
Okay.
But absent that, nothing prevents you from joining with statewide organizations and making the case.
That's right.
Okay. Well, I think that's a great start to kind of developing that better relationship. So we appreciate those comments.
Can I ask you a question about this funding mechanism for preserving unreinforced masonry buildings? So that's one of your recommendations.
Yes.
Are you coming to it, or do we already?
No, we kind of covered it under the resiliency.
So I have an idea where we might get some money, but I don't want to.
Great.
I don't want to get sideways. I don't want to get sideways with the mayor in this setting. So the question I want to ask you is: What thoughts have you come up with? What are some ideas that you have as to where we could find some resources and set them aside? Because I actually think a fund to prevent the kind of demolitions or demolition by neglect and things that we're likely to see is a good idea. Plus, if we have public funding, we can put a string attached. So if it's low cost, affordable art space, and someone wants some assistance, we might be able to get a covenant that says you'll continue to offer the space, you know, for 15 years or whatever. Have you thought about where we could get the resources?
We've only had general discussions about incentives, not necessarily targeted for URMs at the commission level. I mean, I think we would be very, very interested to be, you know, part of a work group. But the discussions we've had with around incentives have, of course, touched on systems development charges and how those can be kind of targeted towards, you know, perhaps owners who keep an existing building and then add more, you know, especially if it's housing. I should add that that BPS and BDS should really have a collaborative relationship to working on that, on SDC charges. I know that that's kind of been a no man's land for them. But I think that that could be a very effective single incentive.
Yeah, I was also thinking, I mean, we've discussed too kind of the relaxation of some permitting fees as being a component. Something that we haven't necessarily discussed, but which just kind of occurred to me is that I've also seen low interest revolving loan programs for like certified rehabilitation programs within jurisdictions. So the idea would be able to provide, you know, a low interest loan to a developer to kind of do the right thing for the historic resource, where you institute some level of seismic stability in exchange for retaining the historic fabric, because they obviously have, you know, a lot of safety issues associated with them in a seismic event, and there's obviously big time costs, and so you kind of have to chip away from it. I don't know if there's a silver bullet for it, though.
Well, I appreciate the list you've given us, because there's some incentives, some deferrals. PDC has a lot of experience with that revolving loan, but that only covers 15% of the city, and so it is not broad enough. We have a related challenge, which is of those 1,500 buildings that are currently being looked at. You know, there's a chunk of them that are affordable housing developments that need to be updated, right, and are not, and the funding is not in their pro forma. And I guess the question we have to address at some point is, at what point do we consider this a public asset that for which public investment is called for? We're having an ongoing conversation about potentially taking over street tree maintenance in the right of way. That's a big idea, but I mean, if we acknowledge that trees provide a public value, and we're going to say we're going to do something, what's the equivalent argument for preserving some of these historic buildings for the long term that might justify some investment of public resources? It's a question.
I think that you can look at it from a number of different perspectives. Certainly, you know, there's some intangible things like a sense of place, sense of character, sense of identity that local citizens certainly attribute to historical areas. But then there's also some of the kind of more hard economic terms that when you rehabilitate a building, you're typically creating more jobs, for instance, because you're putting less of an emphasis on new building materials. So you're exchanging higher costs. If you were to do new construction, when you compare it to a rehabilitation, you're spending more on jobs but less on materials. And so there are ways, I think, of providing that economic justification for historic preservation, and in addition to heritage tourism being another component where there is a little bit more of an active, more public appreciation for a resource, where, you know, people are coming to Portland specifically to see its unique historic neighborhoods, like Ladd's Addition, which is a nationally significant district and which is often paraded around by the National Park Service. Those are the types of things and places that when people come to Portland, they want to see a unique environment such as that.
And then just there's also the straight up sustainability goals of preserving older resources. And, you know, as a city, we have sustainability goals, and preservation should be a part of that. It should really be, you know, one of many menu options that will help us achieve those goals.
We can certainly, you know, provide more information to City Council to perhaps, you know, better illuminate the justification of the expenditure of public funds in such an endeavor. If you'd like to have more information, we can certainly support you in that.
I'm interested in your ideas, and I think the revolving loan fund idea is also interesting. So it's not a deferral. It's not a grant. It's not a waiver of something. But it's a renewable resource that people could take advantage of.
Yep.
Great. Well, I have so many questions that I think I'm just gonna come to one of your meetings.
That'd be great.
Since I've got special privileges. But I did have a couple. Of the 1,442 demolitions between 2012 and 2017, do you know roughly how many of them were of properties that were on that historic resource inventory? I'm sorry to put you on the spot.
I certainly don't know that. Brandon might know that answer. I think if you were to look at the I was trying to figure this out the other day, like approximately what would you expect to see in terms of the percentage of those resources? How, if they were older than 50 years old, they would be prospective historical resources. And my guess would be that probably over 1,000 are older than 50 years old, so they were potential resources. The number of HRI properties removed, though, I don't know. I would estimate a couple hundred, maybe, at the
most. We can find that out.
I'd love to know. Along those same lines, I just want to say that I'm definitely committed to exploring how to fund a new inventory and, you know, looking at that in the 2018-19 budget, because it's been over 30 years, and it's obviously a great concern, you know, among the community. I think... you know, I'm very, very interested in the conversation about how we balance preserving historic buildings and historic neighborhoods, and how we balance that with the need for more density and more affordable housing. And I find that my thoughts and positions often don't satisfy either side. The NIMBYs don't like me, and the YIMBYs don't like me. I will persevere and really look forward to getting to dig into that conversation with you guys.
Great.
Thank you.
Appreciate that. We just got a couple more slides, and then we'll...
Oh, I thought you were done.
We can go through them quickly, I think.
And this is just to kind of wrap up, I guess, in a lot of ways. Our primary priorities and goals are to advocate, obviously to update the HRI. I think you've really kind of captured some of the reasons why. There's planning reasons why, where you want to make planning decisions that are based upon the most up-to-date information that you can possibly get. But the HRI also serves as an opportunity for the public to engage in a process that identifies resources that are important to them, and not just a consultant, not just the Landmarks Commission, and not just the City Council. It really offers an opportunity for them to engage with their own neighborhood, to learn something that they previously hadn't known in the past, and to also kind of put a new set of eyes on to kind of see the places where they live in a new light, because I've experienced that in a number of different communities that I've worked in over the years, and it's a pretty incredible experience to be a part of. We've talked about incentivizing historic preservation. Education is obviously a significant component too, in making sure that we can provide information to the public that will allow them to make truly informed decisions about the expenditure of public funds, and then also to provide leadership when it comes to historic preservation. So we have a few more slides, but I think we've covered all of them, everything that we need to cover. So I just wanted to open it up, I guess, for a last series of questions or concerns that you may share. So.
I'll share a concern.
Yep. Yeah.
And then we have a number of people signed up for public testimony. I want to make sure we hear from folks on that, too. I'm involved in three separate processes that need to be collapsed into one conversation. And somebody up here, maybe it was Commissioner Udaly, mentioned it. There are real trade-offs here. And I think it's naive for us to assume there are not real trade-offs. And the hard part here is drawing the lines. Where is the trade-off? And the three separate processes I'm currently engaged in is this process around protecting our historical assets. And I agree with you. I stipulate everything you said in terms of economic value, community value, a sense of center for the community. All of those things are true. And when I think of our iconic assets, those are our iconic assets, right? But I'm also involved in a conversation around a housing emergency. And there is often a competition between historical preservation and maintaining those assets. And that is a very real trade-off. And you showed a slide of a building that was a victim of one of those trade-offs. In this case, it was the cost of preserving an asset versus the value of commercial space and the asset lost. And then there's this other very real concern around health and safety, knowing that we are now in a fault zone. And many of you were here and had the opportunity to hear the mayor of Christchurch come in and talk about the experience of her community in the wake of a major earthquake and what happened with unreinforced masonry buildings and what that meant for life and safety. And so at some point, these three conversations have to come together. And we have to work and help advise this body not to have three separate conversations with three separate outcomes, but one conversation where we work together to do the best job we can to draw the lines and make the right set of priorities. Not all unreinforced masonry should be preserved and protected. Some of it's junk, and it should probably be scraped and could be used for a better and higher use to the community's value. Others are assets that are literally irreplaceable and should be preserved and should be protected. And you know, we should have the process in place to do that. And I agree with Commissioner Daly. I think it's sort of a shame that we haven't bothered to update the resource inventory since I was in high school. And that was not recently, unfortunately. Yeah. And I appreciate your presentation. I think it's a great presentation, and it's thought-provoking, and it's raising some good issues. So to be continued. I don't know if people have other questions before we get to public testimony.
I do want to mention that we have we do have public testimony on the report, which we haven't been taking recently, but I understand these individuals were invited by BDS.
That's so correct. That is why I'm making an exception and allowing public testimony on this particular report.
I just wanted to clarify that for the audience. Just to kind of wrap up what we've already talked about, I think your input on issues around balancing historic districts or mitigating unintended consequences of historic districts with zoning, with smart zoning, our residential infill policy, which I'm hearing wildly conflicting feedback on, I hope that it's a way for us to encourage preserving older homes while providing kind of a lower impact way to increase density. Other people are convinced we're incentivizing people to just tear everything down, and so I want to make sure that that's not the case, or if it is, that we change it. And then, of course, the whole URM conversation, which is one of the, I think, homelessness, parking, and unreinforced masonry buildings may be the most controversial issues that I've faced in my first year here. And I don't know, I was Googling this while you were talking about financing, and you may have already articulated. Did you talk about our CPACE program?
No.
We have the property assessed program in Multnomah County. It's for commercial buildings, so it only applies to commercial and multifamily of 5 units or more. And it's for green and energy efficiency, but they added seismic retrofits. So that's a good, really useful tool for some property owners. That's it.
I want to just respond to one thing the mayor said. And you were in high school, I think, when this thing was last updated. I was... My parents were actually debating whether to have another child, so it was a different time. So I've been on the council for 9 years, and I just want to acknowledge another dynamic, which is very powerful. 8 or 9 years ago, the constant refrain in this building was, we struck a deal on the urban growth boundary, and we said, we're going to draw a boundary to protect what's on the outside, but we're going to protect the integrity of historical neighborhoods on the inside. And we were going to strike a balance. And actually, the most eloquent person that used to say that on a regular basis here, in my opinion, was Randy Leonard. And whether you like Randy or not, Randy was a historian, and he would go back over the discussion about the urban growth boundary. And we said we're going to put this boundary, protect some farmland, but we're also going to make an accommodation to protect the integrity of our R5 neighborhoods. That was pretty standard fare around here. I'm not saying anything was...
Yeah.
8 or 9 years later, we're talking about revisiting every assumption we ever made about neighborhoods and about what we allow. And we're doing so under the context of an emergency, which gives us more flexibility. My only point that I want to add to this is I don't want this to be too easy to reconcile all these things. I think we have competing values that we have to reconcile, but I don't want personally one particular frame to carry the day. I think it's a healthy process to balance these things and to have this debate and then figure out where we go. And that may not be shared by everybody, but yes, we can get clarity and we can rationalize some of these rules. But we're really talking about harmonizing, in some cases, competing values or things that don't quite fit together. And what I find is that it has the effect of making our discussions richer because we're having to sort of balance, and there's no right answer. But it was a very different conversation 8 years ago. I mean, it was fundamentally different, and the urban growth boundary discussion guided a little bit of our view. And now we've opened up just about everything, and times change. But I think that's also why we're hearing so much anxiety from the community, because they're not clear about what the rules are anymore. People aren't sure where we're headed. And there's a growing movement that I think if they had the choice, people would put up a barrier to prevent people from coming into our city. And that's not a healthy thing, but it is reflecting and reflects a certain frustration.
And I would agree with everything that you said, that there really are no easy answers. I think what the Historic Landmarks Commission would really like, though, is to have a voice in these conversations and to be able to contribute our opinions. And that's something we've been able to do, to some degree. But certainly I also agree with the mayor. Not every building is worth preserving. There are no black and whites here. There is an affordable housing crisis. We recognize all of these things. And
I think we'd really like to be a part of the solution.
Exactly.
Because I think that I come from a social science background, and to looking at quantifiable data so that you can kind of really arrive at a general understanding of what exactly the problems are, because I think that's where really the rubber hits the road in terms of coming up with a solution is really getting down to the nitty gritty and figuring out, even on these complex problems such as housing, how economics, the market, historic preservation, the environment all kind of come in and intersect, and really developing kind of
parking.
And the whole, the cost benefit analysis from a public perspective, that if you're expending public funds on historic preservation, is that justified when we're in the midst of a housing crisis? That's not an insignificant question to ask in terms of when you're allocating funds for one program or another.
And it's supposed to be that way. We have 19 statewide planning goals, and none of them are more important. Each is their own that has to be considered, and citizen involvement being the first one. So we very much appreciate your coming to give your perspective. And it does allow for intelligent people, for earnest and caring people to have these conversations and figure out some solutions. Because I actually don't think it has to be one or the other. I think we can do internal conversions of older houses and have three families living there instead of one, for example. We can do accessory dwelling units in the backyard. There's all kinds of things that we can do to add density that doesn't destroy the fabric of the neighbourhood. And I say that with my British accent, in a country that literally you can go and see new housing, and they're accommodating lots of refugees and growth within the country. And yet it's still... It looks like England every time I go back there. And it doesn't have skyscrapers in every city. In fact, most of the multi-story apartments don't exist anymore because there's better ways of getting people to have a community rather than just a place to be sheltered. So I think it's encouraging that we have that you have brought to us, that yes, this historic preservation is important, and if we don't preserve them, then we're not going to be able to say in 20 years' time, never mind 200 years' time, this is what Portland is all about.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. We've certainly appreciated the discussion today, and we look forward to working with you all in the very near future.
Thank you. Great. Thank you. How many people for public testimony?
We have 12.
Very good. 3 minutes each. Name for the record, please.
Okay. The first three, please, coming up are Heather Flint Chatto, Linda Nedekoven, and William Willingham. Willingham.
Good afternoon. Would you like to go ahead and start?
Sure.
Thank you.
Forgive me, I'm going to read a little bit from something I've already written. My name is Heather Flint Chatto. I'm an urban designer and urban planner and have been doing environmental green building work for the last 17 years. And for the last 4 years, we've been leading Nedekoven and I, along with a coalition of four different neighborhood associations and business associations, to foster more community engagement and education around design and empower our community to have a greater voice in the planning process as part of the Division Design Initiative. Welcome to learn more about that on our website, divisiondesigninitiative.org. So we have been developing design guidelines as part of that process, really trying to have clearer clarification of what our goals and priorities are. So as we've been tracking this, we've identified a lot of critical issues that were beyond just what was happening on Division, but also across the city as a whole. We've done surveys, walking tours, 2 years of open public committee meetings and things like that. So this is very relevant because a lot of our streetcar era main streets are not necessarily designated as historic, but provide a really important, rich fabric that is the identity and our sense of place. And I'm very, very concerned, and I think many are, that we are losing our soul, that we are losing what makes us the creative cultural hub that has been our legacy of really good planning. This has been our mecca of sustainability, and that is one of the reasons I have loved this city. And I have to say, my love affair is wavering at times. I still feel it in many parts of the city, but I feel personally very impacted, as I see many other people. And if you were to go and look at our survey, which we submitted to the city, 300 people responded very deeply concerned about the character and lack of context that our new development is showing. So as we... I want to really just appreciate the work that this preservation report has highlighted and request that you consider that there might need to be something different for our streetcar era historic main streets. This is something that's beyond Southeast, but you know, Belmont, Hawthorne, Division have a very similar character to Fremont and Alberta and many streets in Selwood. So I encourage you to look at the possibility of a different treatment, a form-based code perhaps, a set of incentives that you already heard about. I didn't need to mention them because you already had a great list, but that perhaps that incentivization might also need something different, not only just for the main street, but an incentivization for the bigger streets. Like in our neighborhood, for example, Powell is supposed to be one of our great civic corridors, and in our neighborhood, we'd like to see maybe potentially a shift to maybe pass on some of those bonuses of development there. So I really support the update to the historic resources inventory on a fast-track process because we're losing so much so quickly, and also to give the opportunity to advocate more on behalf of our preservation. So I certainly would be happy to talk with any of you more if you're interested in learning more about our
very
work.
Very good. Thank you very much. Good afternoon.
Yes, my name is William Willingham, and I'd like to speak to the issue of redoing the historic inventory. And I come to you with special knowledge on that matter because I was the historian who did the original inventory 35 years ago. Al Staley, who's an architect, and myself did all of the work. He did the windshield surveys. I did the historical research. We then submitted the information to Virginia Faraday, who oversaw the city staff, that collated it excuse me, and collated it all, and then we did the ranking process. We took the 5,000 structures and divided them into three sections, the top 50 rank or tier one, and then about 200 in tier two, and the rest were in tier three. Now, I think there are probably three good reasons why this work needs to be updated. And one other special item that I'll throw in before I go to those three is that